We have a very distinguished panel this morning, and the subject will be Control Operator's Perspective. We're going to lead off with Mike McMullen, who is the Director, West Regional Operations, Midwest ISO. Mike, how many MISO presentations have we had?
I wasn't here yesterday.
Okay, you have a choice of either speaking from here or from the podium, whatever works for you. Fine, just...
Thank you. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the control area operator's perspective. As you'll see in the presentation, at this point, MISO is not a control area, or it's now termed a balancing area in NERC terms. I'll start out with just a kind of an overview of Midwest ISO from the operating side of it. You can see up here the different regions within the Midwest ISO. We break those up. We are a reliability coordinator. Part that I focus on is the West region, which does have the most amount of seams in the Midwest ISO, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Our East region and Central region cover the rest of it. As you can see, we have a large geographical area. If you kind of envision the parts of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, parts of Iowa, parts of Wisconsin, the part of the energy market that we run, the reliability footprint covers the whole area there in the West. The market footprint more or less covers Minnesota and then the other parts, a little bit of Iowa, Manitoba, Wisconsin. But we have a large seam pretty much running down the Dakotas and Nebraska and Iowa, which gives us many operational issues. This breaks it up into current balancing areas and transmission operators. It's not as important as far as the individual entity itself, just again that these seams issues as they come up. I'll talk a little bit more about it as we get some extra slides here, but it's a fun operating region. We have challenges every day, all the way from wind, which is normally a good challenge, just transmission itself. Certainly weather in the area is always can be a major impact on any given day. As we start getting into the snow and ice season, those are some of the worst ones. So, we are, with the Midwest ISO, becoming a NERC-certified balancing area. June 2008, we anticipate starting our ancillary service market. Part of that does have us becoming a balancing area. Initially, it was talked about as far as consolidating the balancing areas into one. What we're really doing is just coordinating all of the current balancing areas. They still retain their NERC certification as a local balancing area with the Midwest ISO managing the overall balancing area itself. They were divided up all of the NERC requirements. As far as who is responsible for each, some of the requirements have some of both of us having to do it. Other ones are just solely the LBA, as it's called, local balancing area, or the Midwest ISO balancing area. As you saw in the previous slide, it will be a large geographical area. I believe we'll be the second largest, load-wise, second largest balancing area in the country. As I showed again, the balancing area will not include, at least at this point, the non-market side of this region. So some of the entities that are not currently part of the Midwest ISO market will not be inside the Midwest ISO balancing area. They will be adjacent balancing areas and will continue to do business as they do today. With now, it'll be a Midwest ISO balancing area, which is the adjacent one to them, not the other one. So, there are, and maybe you heard a little bit about this yesterday, maybe you'll hear some more today, there are efforts going on right now with these non-market participants to try to give them some options about being able to dispatch the generation inside the Midwest ISO market. As a operator, I find that very exciting that if we can get additional generation and transmission inside that balancing area boundary, it makes our operating, I won't necessarily say easier, but it makes it where it's much more comparable. So I'll talk a little bit more on the next slide or two, some of the seams, the way we have to handle these seams issues when there's congestion involved. It takes up a reliability coordinator's a large amount of their time on any given shift. So if these efforts get some more generation in the market, the market side of it does a very good job of redispatching around this congestion, and overall it's a powerful tool. So there's still congestion there, but it does, price signals will allow that to be relieved. So I'm looking forward to all the efforts that are going on for these entities that aren't currently in the market over the next year to hopefully see some of them come in, and would be glad to help dispatch their generations. A little bit about wind in the Midwest ISO footprint. By the end of the year, we're going to have approximately 1,900 megawatts of wind in the Midwest ISO footprint. As I'm sure you've heard, a lot of that is located in this general area of the country. Again, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Iowa. There's a large amount of wind capability there, and a lot of it's already online. Just in the last couple months, there's been upwards of 700 megawatts that have come into our system. I'll see a graph coming up here, just some of the challenges of wind. But one of the bigger ones with this amount of wind is the wind forecasting capability. And we have to get that capability inside the Midwest ISO. We're working on it. The technology is there, but there's still some challenges with wind forecasting depending on how far out you're going to go. An hour or two out, there's some pretty good ideas of what the wind's going to do. As you start getting out to a day or two, the capability of that, as you know, is less at that point. But there's a lot of effort going on there, and again, we're working with that to be able to do a good job of wind forecasting. The entities that have the wind right now, they are doing individual forecasting and do a good job of, for the most part, of getting that forecasting capability into the different markets, different time horizons of the market, whether it's the day ahead, the financial market. The next one comes in and says we have to cover all our load to do our reliability assessment commitment. Those look at the wind also to make sure in the next day that there's enough other generation available in a short horizon if need be, if the wind that is offered in for the day ahead market is not actually there in real time. And then in real time itself, each day we're watching the wind. If we have an idea if it's going to be increasing or decreasing, that'll impact our real time operations also. A couple quick bullets, just what we have seen over the last year or two is the geographical diversity of the wind is a very good thing. It's you don't see as many of the low lows that you would if it's all concentrated in one area and all of a sudden the wind dies down. So you don't get that quick drop off of 800 or 900 megawatts of wind that you could see if it was all lumped into one place. It's just a quick picture of a day. And even this does not include some of the last chunks of wind that have come in. So even though you're seeing upwards of 800 or 900 megawatts of wind in the first time horizon, this is a 48-hour period here. And these are some of the challenges we see. If you look kind of right in the middle of that graph, you can see the quick drop-off. That's 200 or so megawatts in less than an hour. Again, geographical diversity. If we were up at 800 or 900 megawatts and that same front came through, obviously that would be a larger impact, but 200 megawatts we can certainly handle in a large footprint that we have. It may be an additional generator comes online for a quick start if we're really that tight, or it can just be made up with some of the extra capacity that may be online at the time. So depending on the time of the day, it'll dictate whether we have to start another generator or not. But you can see the variability over that 40-hour period of we're upwards of 900 megawatts at one point. If you think about it as you're that time frame there, you're getting ready for the next day. If without forecasting capability, if you say, well, we're up there and we'll plan on that for the next day also, obviously that didn't happen for that full day. So that forecasting capability is very important, and as I said, we're working hard on that. So, but it's a good picture here of the sample. Earlier this week, we had gone through a tighter energy day. There was some larger units that had been forced off for various reasons. Some of the initial cold temperatures coming in that particular day, as it went through evening peak, there was 900 to 1,000 megawatts of wind that was in the footprint at the time. It was a very good thing for us that day. On that same, some of the same days in the summer when it's not there, those are when you get the people saying, well, it's not there when you need it, but we had a day this week where it was very helpful for us. Some of the questions and comments about the seams. The biggest one in the operating horizon is just the congestion management. Inside the market, as congestion occurs across a particular area, have the capability to redispatch the market generators. As you get closer to a seam, to be comparable, depending on the seam can be outside the market or inside, the way to be comparable there is with TLR, curtailing tags that are outside the market. It gets to be, as I said before, the large part of a reliability coordinator's day can be spent doing this to make sure it's comparable and equitable between all parties. So it's that seam is probably the biggest operating issue that we have. So I'm sure you heard a lot about the generation interconnection queues, and I'm not going to talk too much about that. There are some things that can be done as far as generation, wind generation outside the market can be pseudo-tied inside the market if that is one of the options. And I'm sure you heard a lot about the generation interconnection queue yesterday, so I'm not going to expand on that at all at this point. As I said before, some of these options that are out there for these non-market participants, what that does essentially is move the seam if some of them would choose to participate inside the market. So we'll look forward to those seams moving. It could be in every 3 months where all of a sudden a seam that runs through the middle of Iowa could now run across the Iowa-South Dakota area, Iowa-Nebraska, some of those type seams. So it's... In the long run, I think we'll get there where the seams will be worked out, but they are there right now, and we struggle with them every day. Just the amount of wind that is coming in, and as we get it into a larger geographical area, increase some of the reserves and load following that are required out there. Some of the ancillary service market will help manage that. The larger the area that we can handle that, the more we can handle it, regulating and load following. Don't necessarily need questions at this point, but I just want to say that thank you for the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you, Mike. We'll hold the questions until all the panelists have had made their presentations. Our next panelist is Ward Ugarud, who is Chief Operating Officer for Energy Supply at Otter Tail Power Company.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. It's an amazing crowd and an amazing conference that's been arranged, so thanks to those who were a part of that. I'd like to provide a utilities perspective to the development of additional generation resources and transmission resources within the region. My job simply, in terms of the energy supply officer with my company, is to provide electricity as reliably and economically as possible, and to do so within the context of facilitating energy policy. Energy policy is not a single faceted issue. It is comprised of basically these elements. Included is to provide electricity as reliably and economically as possible. But there are other elements as well, and that is to promote energy independence, to enhance the development of additional renewable energy resources, to promote economic development, address global climate change, and to provide for increasing levels of environmental protection. Now, keep in mind that there is a relationship between these goals. Some are supportive of each other, but others are in conflict with some. And achieving the optimum blend of meeting these goals is not a precise science. It requires flexibility, and it requires collaboration. No one of these energy policy objectives can be met without considering the impact on others. Since we are here at a wind and transmission conference, I'd like to discuss these issues from a utilities perspective. I'll also point out that the perspective that I am presenting to you comes from having spent 36 years in a career of providing energy resources to the area. I have done that under the watchful eye of our regulators, our state legislatures, our federal Congress, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and the North American Electric Reliability Council. I would also say that the perspective I come from includes having served as chairman of both the operating committees of the Mid-Continent Area Power Pool and the North American Electric Reliability Council. So let me discuss the issues of energy policy as they relate to wind, transmission, and traditional generation resources. First, from the standpoint of economics and reliability, I don't think that as we go around our service territory that any one of our customers would argue that cost and reliability is not an issue. And perhaps everybody in this room would agree as well. The problem with the issues of economics and reliability is not all of the rules are written yet. You have existing law, but you also have a great deal of speculation as to what the laws might become. But if you strip away all the hyperbola, you have known costs, you have known costs of operation, you have known costs of integration, you can assign values for emissions and credits, and you can assign cost to cost causation, and you can come up with an answer. But in the end, customers will want the lowest cost and the most reliable product that meets the expectations of our society, and there are no free lunches. With regard to energy independence is achieved when generation resources do not require a foreign energy product. There are fuels available domestically that would provide for electricity to be produced without the need for foreign energy products. Domestic fuels include biomass, waste fuel, wind, and coal, but intermittent resources, which require a degree of backup, do have a component of them that includes a foreign energy dependence. With regard to renewable energy development, I'd like to point out that we are a part of the communities that we serve, and we have been working with renewable energy developers. Personally, I have been meeting with a group of farmers in our service territory over a number of years and have provided assistance to them in trying to help achieve the development of a wind energy product. But every time we have talked to a renewable energy developer, they have said that there are two primary obstacles to the development of renewable energy resources, and those are the lack of transmission and the need to have a buyer for the wind energy that is produced. Now, the footprint of our service territory and the footprint of the neighboring utilities in the area sits in some of the best wind resources in the country. Otter Tail Power Company and all of our neighboring utilities are working with the development groups to try and achieve additional development of wind energy resources. Otter Tail Power Company and all of our neighboring utilities are committed to the development of additional renewable energy resources. Otter Tail Power Company and our neighboring utilities are proposing to build additional transmission that would be used expressly for the purpose of integrating additional renewable energy resources. Otter Tail Power Company and our neighboring utilities are also proposing to build additional traditional baseload generation resources because those are needed to integrate the operation of the renewable energy resources that will be built. From the standpoint of economic development, both renewable energy resources and traditional energy resources need capital investments, and those capital investments provide for a significant degree of economic development. Dollars spent locally do have impacts on the economy. The tax bases that are provided when those resources are built do provide funding for schools, communities, and infrastructure projects. There is no particular advantage to one form of energy development over another as it relates to economic development. And I would also point out that the cost of energy associated with the production of electricity is also an economic development issue. With regard to global climate change, there is a significant amount of debate on this issue nationally. No one disputes the fact that there is a global climate change debate out there. But I would like to just follow a little bit on the comment of Mike Hansen from the previous panel. The United States produces electricity as energy efficiently as any other country in the world. We are the most carbon-intensive producing country in the world, but that's in large part related to a lifestyle that we hold out as being one that we're proud of. It relates to the fact that we produce goods and services that are sold in the entire world. It relates to a lifestyle that allows us to have flat-screen TVs. We own more automobiles per capita than any other country in the world. We drive more miles per person than any other country in the world because of the large geographical area of our country. We provide goods and services that require the use of energy in order to make them and sell them in a global economy. If there is going to be a carbon constraint, then any resource that produces electricity or any other product and does so as energy efficiently as possible will have a value associated with it. Just because it produces carbon does not necessarily make it bad if it's the most energy efficient way to produce that good and service. Advanced coal generation has the same relative impact on the carbon footprint as does moving to a hybrid electric vehicle. The United States cannot meet its electric energy needs alone without the development of traditional energy resources in conjunction with renewable energy resources. With regard to environmental performance, since we've talked about carbon separately, that leaves us simply with the other pollutants, SO2, NOx, and mercury. The standards for licensing and permitting facilities are based on detailed health-based analyses. New coal plants today have essentially the same environmental emissions profile as do gas-fired power plants. Furthermore, with introduction of a proposal for a plant at Big Stone Unit Number 2, we have agreed as participants in that project to have a 100% carbon offset with regard to the Minnesota portion of that project. Now, I would just submit to you that if instead of a traditional advanced coal-fired power plant at that site, we had renewable energy resources that required a backup because those sources would be intermittent, that alternative would not have a zero carbon emission profile with regard to Minnesota. So in conclusion, renewable generation development is going to be an evolving and growing part of our national energy policy. Renewable generation development, however, will not be the only resource development needed. An integrated, balanced portfolio approach is going to be required in order to have an optimum balance in order for this country to proceed with the same degree of economics that we have had historically. renewable generation resources will require transmission development in order to integrate into the network. Renewable generation resources will need additional forms of generation to provide for the integration to the network, to provide for backup reserves, voltage control, and ancillary services. And a coordinated approach will be necessary in order to accomplish this. And that coordinated approach must occur between the proponents of various types of resources, and it must occur between the various states, the federal government, and all of the entities that want to participate in the energy industry within this country. Thank you for the time to be with you today.
Thank you, Ward. Our next panelist is Will Caw. He is Vice President, Transmission at Great River Energy, and he's also chairman of the CapEx 2020 program.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. You think you probably heard enough about CapEx, but you're going to hear some more, and I hope that you won't find it too redundant, although there are some points I do want to repeat. But before I get into my presentation, I wanted to just clarify one thing that was brought up earlier about quick take condemnation authority in Minnesota. And if I understood the comment correctly, it was that there wasn't such a thing as quick take in Minnesota, but there is. And it's used frequently by utilities. It's a device that we can use when we have all of our permits and are ready to go, but we don't have agreement with a landowner over the price. So we can go ahead within 90 days, and when the agreement is determined by the commissioners, then the landowner will get reimbursed. On CapEx, I want to, for those of you who aren't familiar, just talk a little bit about the history of the organization, where we came from. We were formed in the spring of 2004. It was initially an effort of four utilities who were very concerned about meeting their obligations to serve their customers. So in shorthand, that means that we are concerned about reliability in our region, in our service territory. The group expanded to 11 utilities, which is essentially all the transmission utilities in Minnesota. And their service territories weren't just Minnesota, it was eastern Dakotas and western Wisconsin. We originally referred to ourselves as a faith-based organization, and the reason for that was that we had no agreements. We shared in common this concern about serving our customers and providing reliable service. It's a very unique collaboration in the country. We have Group 1 projects now underway. They're in the permitting process in Minnesota. They are very significant. It's about 700 miles of line. You saw some of the maps, et cetera, yesterday that showed the projects. About $1.5 billion of investment, which is probably the single largest electric infrastructure improvement ever undertaken in Minnesota. So it is a big deal. These are the projects. They were planned to work together to provide reliable service, and primarily that is their cause, but they do do other things. They provide additional generation interconnection capacity, and they should help to support the renewable energy portfolio requirements in Minnesota. One of the things that was very important in getting to this point among the group of utilities was solving the cost allocation issue. And we worked long and hard on that. We had a very difficult time with it. And there are comments about RECB yesterday and revisiting it. But I will say that RECB 1 was what broke the logjam for us. We were getting close. And when RECB 1 came out, we all looked at it and said, oh, close enough. And so that was very important to us. And it's very important to implications for moving forward on some other even tougher cost allocation issues. When you're talking about reliability, it's easy for you to kind of pin that one down. Everyone can relate to it and understand it. You can see who the beneficiaries are. When you're looking at generation interconnection, it immediately gets more difficult. And RECB did it take a run at that and has a tariff proposal for generation interconnection, which requires a generator pay 50%, and 50% goes to area load. That works if you have a natural gas peaking plant. It doesn't work so well for wind. And so taking our faith-based organization to the next step, the Brookings Project here has a large dimension of generation interconnection because it's going to provide outlet for wind on the Buffalo Ridge. And the CapEx utilities now are trying to sort that out. We're proceeding with the project. We think we'll be able to come to a conclusion on how costs are allocated, but we're going to need the support of, we're going to need alignment amongst ourselves. We're going to need the support of regulators to get that done. But we are moving ahead with that project. You saw this timeline yesterday, but really it just to emphasize the point that these projects do take time, 7 or 8 years from the conception to in-service date for these large 345 kV projects. And it's a long time between now and the year 2014 or 2013 when these projects are in service. And so one of the things that CapEx is doing, and Terry mentioned it yesterday, is we're looking at a smaller wind generation projects, which in Minnesota we call seabed projects, community-based energy developments, and seeing where we can fit them in, find the niches in the system, the sweet spots, if you will, where we can add new wind generation while we're building out these bigger projects. This is a very important effort that we have ongoing right now. Challenges ahead. We're lacking a regional strategy, and this is kind of my my mantra. I've been talking about this for several years. We have several political jurisdictions in this area. We have both the Dakotas, we have Minnesota. I'd really like to see an overarching regional strategy for energy development in these three states. We have different requirements in different states. We have different processes in different states, and they don't all fit together very well right now. And if you're doing transmission planning and you're doing planning for reliability, that's one thing. We can figure that out. If you're doing planning for generation interconnection, we have to know what we're building for. We have to know where the resources are going to be located. We need to know what the behavior of those resources is. And that, to me, speaks to a vision on the resource side. So we strongly urge all the policymakers in this room to be thinking in broad regional terms. In terms of the MISO queue, and using that as some indication of where new resources might be located, we all heard about the queue yesterday, and it is clogged, and it's really hard to tell what's real there. So it isn't very helpful to us. I want to compliment Mike Bull yesterday, who came up. He's the assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I think made a very a gracious statement about, at least from Minnesota's point of view, they're not going to be parochial about where everything is located. It looks like there's enough resource development opportunities to go around for all three states. We have a very rich resource, and I'm hoping that all of the states can share that view. One thing we're doing to help get us to a regional resource vision from transmission planning point of view is we're doing this generation and transmission optimization study that Terry talked about yesterday. And the purpose of that study is to provide some kind of an economic basis for where these resources can be located and the trade-offs between the generation costs and the transmission costs. We're working very hard on that and hope to have some results in the not-too-distant future. One other thing I'll say in terms of the resource vision is that it's not just wind, and I think we all know that. But there are, and Ward talked about other kinds of resources. Hydro just really has to be part of this picture. It's such a good complement to wind. Natural gas, baseload, we need more than wind. And then disregard this slide. I was thinking yesterday and listening to all these different discussions, and it was a great day yesterday. I wanted to make a couple of, I guess what I would call summary statements about CapEx and beyond CapEx and where we're going as an organization. But we have in the pipeline or planned projects that will take us through 2016. And that's very significant. And I mean 2016 in terms of Minnesota renewable portfolio requirements. So we think we have that covered. And I think it's a very important message for people here to know that we are planning and building transmission at an unprecedented rate, and we are planning to meet the requirements of these renewable portfolio standards. One of the things that we did that has allowed us to accomplish that and to get so much momentum going is that we formed a coalition at the 2005 state legislative session that really put the public policy in alignment around developing this new transmission. We got formula rates that now are also in place in North and South Dakota. We got some streamlining of the regulatory review process. I think we got a lot of support. We got what we need to get the job done. We believe we can get all these projects done. We think there's going to be some bloodlet in terms of acquiring right-of-ways and some of the routing process, but we think we have the kind of alignment, the public policy alignment, to get it done. What we're looking at now is what happens after 2016. And that's the hard part. And I think Tom Filer yesterday put it very well. He said it's a matter of scale. And even beyond 2016, and even just with CapEx projects for Minnesota's requirements alone, we're looking at voltages that go beyond 345. And Claire Moeller last year was the first one to utter the word 765. I think it was at this conference. And that's where we think we're going to. And that's a whole new ball game. And it's a whole new ball game on a whole bunch of different fronts. I was talking about alignment, the alignment that we had in Minnesota to get what we're doing now done. We need alignment on a whole different scale. We need Minnesota regulators to start thinking about, are they willing to have Minnesota be a corridor to the east? And what about Wisconsin? What about other states farther to the east? I was talking with Bill Malcolm last night with the OMS. He thinks it's they're not quite ready to embrace that. And yet, the timeline, the planning timeline for building projects of that scale is a very long one. It might be 15 years or something like that. So there is a lot of challenges out there in terms of not just state alignment, but state and federal alignment around policy. The other thing that is a key question, of course, and as Claire mentioned yesterday, is so who's going to pay for it? Another major public policy issue, very difficult one, and I think we have a ways to go before we get there. Our state utilities or state regulatory commission is willing to give up jurisdiction for things like the transmission component of the bundled retail rate. Are they willing to give up jurisdiction on siting? These things are kinds of things I think are going to be required to get these big projects done. And finally, going back to Tom Filer again yesterday, he said transmission. And I'm offering a friendly amendment to his thought there, which is transmission, regional vision for resource development, and regulatory alignment. I think those are the three things we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. I have a couple lead-off questions for the panel here. I've been thinking of, you know, Mike, when you develop your day-ahead wind forecasting and perfect it, are you going to sell it to the Weather Service? I mean, we have a problem getting the day-ahead forecasts and weather.
I don't think we would do that. We're trying to get in there to use whatever technology is out there, whether it is the Weather Service, whoever, some of the different entities out there that have this capability. So we're trying to get in there, but we certainly wouldn't be producing it for any other thing at this point.
Well, you know, it sounds like a very challenging problem to try and determine what the wind is going to be, especially looking at your graph of the sudden dip. I think it was 200 megawatts you showed. I'm kind of curious, are you collecting data directly from all of these wind sites to give you the input for this process?
We get the data right now through the local balancing areas, transmission operators. They get the data into their current control area. That data then continues on in the Midwest ISO for our reliability coordination efforts. And so that's how we're getting it now. We'd continue to get it that way as they come online, so as they get interconnected.
Thank you. Will, you talked about who's going to pay for these transmission lines. Are your members of CapEx going to be the parties that are going to be building these lines, or what are the mechanics of that process?
The CapEx coalition members each is an investor in the all of these CapEx projects in different ways. And what we did was we came up and agreed upon a share that represents maybe a percentage or some expected dollar amount for each utility that will contribute to these projects. And then we threw what we call the poker chip exercise, which is, let's say, Great River Energy has $150 million that it needs to invest, and we decided, well, we're going to put $50 million on this project and $50 on this one and $50 on that one, and everyone else did the same. And then we jiggled it around until we had enough for each project. And so each project essentially has its own participants. Turns out each project has about 5 participants, and they're different in every project. So that's how we divvied it up.
Anyone from the audience with any questions? Yes.
Yeah, my question is for Kevin Porter from Exeter Associates. My question is for Mike from the Midwest side. So I wanted to ask a little more about the wind forecasting. Are you thinking of using an outside vendor, and are you looking at sort of a central forecast that you would hold the wind generators to, sort of like what California does, what New York is thinking of doing? I'm just trying to get a little bit more detail about where you're going with that.
At this point, it would just be to get the capability in so that we can operate over different horizons such that we have a better idea of what that wind's going to do so that we don't either have to overcommit so we have extra generation online when it's not needed, or not have it available if that, not only the dips, but just the general trend, say it goes down 900 megawatts in a 12-hour period. That same thing has to be ready so we can have that generation. But it wouldn't necessarily be our forecast and have them hold to it. Right now, the individual entities are essentially offering in that wind in their best estimate, so they are held to it in that aspect right now in the day-ahead market. So,
Bruce Poole, consultant, and a question in the same vein. The systems I've seen, for forecasting wind can be pretty good, and they're pretty intensive to get them set up. Problem is, to really use one effectively, you have to have some sort of standard protocol that identifies how you're going to put it in. In other words, I'm going to take all wind whenever I can get it, and everything else has got to go back down, okay? And then you forecast it to plug it in like that. But that means that you're not going to be economic in some conditions. Is that what you're thinking, or is it going to be driven by market?
Right now, the wind entities are treated as intermittent units, so they, if they're online producing, they are taken into the market unless there is an operating guide that says it's dealing with congestion in the area that we would then, whether it's curtail wind or lessen the wind some based on that operating guide. But normally, in an uncongested area, that wind would be allowed to come into the market and produce it. So,
okay.
I'm Susan Wiefald from the North Dakota Public Service Commission, and yesterday WAPA talked about the difficulties of incorporating wind into their balancing area. And would each of you talk about what you see, even if you're going to be some of you are going to be incorporated in a year or so into the MISO control area. But in the meantime, let's say over the next 2 years or so, would you talk about the difficulties of that you see, or if you don't see any difficulties, of incorporating more wind into your balancing areas, because I think this becomes a big issue. If you see that there's a lot of difficulties of incorporating wind into your balancing areas, we won't see as much wind being developed. If you see that it can happen easily, then perhaps we'll see more, because WAPA has identified that there is a big problem there, and that's one of the reasons we're not seeing as much wind development occurring in the WAPA balancing area.
I'll just briefly start out by saying that a larger balancing area will help in that aspect. If you get the wind generation coming in into a larger footprint, it is easier to manage those 200 to 500 megawatt increases and decreases. You've got a wider footprint that can be redispatched around that. So in that aspect, the larger area helps getting the wind in. I do see WAPA's concerns in a smaller balancing area. It does get to be an issue as a large chunk of wind comes in. So,
you know, clearly if you try and integrate a significant amount of an intermittent resource without having dedicated transmission associated with that, you're going to have problems integrating the wind. However, if you go to the other extreme, and I'm not advocating that you do, but if every megawatt of wind that was developed had its own dedicated transmission outlet, then you wouldn't have any problems integrating wind into the area. So I think that it becomes a matter of what kind of regulatory and legislative policies are we really going to develop for the development of renewable energy resources. Now, I heard a panelist speak before about the need for recognizing regional differences. And, you know, in all due respect to Mike, he's a good friend and I regard him highly, but, you know, you consume a lot of beef in Hennepin County, and you don't raise a lot of beef in Hennepin County. So I don't think that the paradigm of having to produce renewable energy resources where it's being consumed is necessarily the only paradigm that you have to consider. You could develop a financial product for renewable energy credits, and you could develop the renewable energy resources in the areas of the country where the wind is the best, and you could sell them on a national basis if we just had a regulatory and legislative protocol developed that would allow for that to happen. I think that from my personal perspective, I think that that would be the better approach for the country to take. There's clearly a lot of discussion with regard on a national basis to encourage the development of renewable energy resources. Then, my goodness, why not develop those in the areas that have got the best wind energy resources available to them? And that's going to require more transmission, and that's going to require the cooperation of the states and the federal government in order to build that transmission. That's why the CapEx proposal, I think, is visionary. That recognizes that there is a need for transmission to meet national energy policy goals.
I'll add my two cents worth, and I'll start out small. Let's say before MISO market, Great River Energy thinking about integrating wind, horrible problem. We have to follow that load ourselves. It's very expensive. Enter MISO market, best thing that ever happened for wind. We can add all kinds of wind, and the market can support that. Wind displaces natural gas in the dispatch order. Many great things about the marketplace. So then he gets to a point where how much wind can that marketplace absorb? And we did a study in Minnesota, I think a year or two ago, on wind integration, I think up to about 25%. And assuming all of our CapEx transmission was built, that came at a minimal cost, let's say. But there's a point where if you have too much wind, or let's say more wind than you can easily integrate, you're in a situation, and I think one of our panelists talked about it yesterday, where you start backing down baseload nuclear and other cheap resources, and without transmission to move that wind to distant markets, you run into a real limit there.
I think, yeah, we should take the final two questions here, and then we're going to move on to the next session.
Most of this discussion has been talking about macro balancing issues, but there is also the micro balancing issues that the consumer will do. I get both Autotail and Rural Electric Power, and both offer off-peak demand control and so on. And that is one of the major things that does allow these utilities to actually micromanage I think we have to emphasize the micro that will go on with the consumer making the decisions that can make for large amounts of difference. The second point is that 40% of all the energy used in America goes to heating and cooling, housing, and commercial. We're totally off on the wrong track if we don't consider what our housing is doing to us and how to take and utilize that energy that's extra, put it into mass buildings so that we can contain that mass for 24 hours. I've built two houses that are mass buildings. They don't know the difference between day and night, 1 week to the next, and I can use off-peak totally. So there's a lot of things to do besides the macro balancing.
Hi, I'm Josh Steinigel from WindLogix. Currently, our group is doing a lot of wind energy forecasting for a little over 5,000 megawatts across the U.S. right now, and are working on some solutions to bring that data to control room operators in a usable fashion. But one of the biggest stumbling blocks we have is getting information like curtailment and unit commitment from the wind farm operators in real time. When we lack that information, it substantially hurts the accuracy of the forecasts. And we're wondering if anything's being done right now across the ISOs or with the individual utilities to storehouse that information and make it available to the forecasters so we can get you guys better information in real time.
Right now I know that those type of things are available at the local entities, whether it's Midwest ISO or the utilities. Getting that information out hasn't been done in a real-time fashion. So it's recognized as one of the issues around the forecasting from both sides. We have for us to get a good forecast from people like you and to get you the information back you need to create that forecast. So.
Katie, it's all yours.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and thank again everyone on this panel.